physical form. So begin to work with making a sculpture. Now, don't think of something monumental that's going to go in the Civic Center. Something small. You can work with any medium that you want. Clay or plaster of Paris is probably the easiest. You can use found objects, whatever you wish. But try to, in the next week, work with some form. And bring what you have next week as far as you get. And I'm going to show you some slides of some Henry Moore sculptures next week and talk a little bit about sculpture. But the contrast that I want to develop for you now is the movement from words to the hands-on object. I want to make a kind of a sense of a discontinuity here, or what seems to be an apparent discontinuity, but actually is a continuity on a very deep level. With your poiesis, the Greek word poiesis, which meant to make, to create, out of which we get poetry. Poiesis. For the Greek sense of poiesis, there is a coordination of hand and eye on the fulcrum of the mind. The mind as a fulcrum balances the hand and the eye. Now, some of you have seen maybe that great statue of Zeus that was found in the 1890s, 1880s, off the Aegean coast of Cape Sunia, not too far from Athens. And Zeus has his hand raised back and the other hand straight out. And there once was apparently a javelin in his hand, or a lightning bolt. But all that we have is the incredibly accurate posture, which symbolically gives us the coordination of hand and eye to throw a javelin or a lightning bolt exactly. The hand and the eye must be coordinated exactly. But the implicit symbol there is that of the balance of the mind that allows hand and eye to come together. And there is a deeper significance to this, which is the core of the Hellenic spirit. The hand is really the ritual implement par excellence. The hand. In a ritual sense, it's the intelligence of the hand that is the most primordial apprehension of man. The whole graspability of anything is symbolized by the hand. And while the apprehension and the graspability is symbolized by the hand, the comprehension, the penetration, the insight, is symbolized by the eye, so that the eye and the hand are balanced. And because they're both very primordial of their respective realms, the hand of the ritual mythic area, the eye of the magic artistic area, because they are primordial, they are only able to be balanced by the perfect mind. Not just the mind, but the mind honed to perfection, in the sense that the mind is capable of exercising a balance of hand and eye. This is why one of the most primordial of all the sculptural forms was early pottery. Early pottery. For millennia, for tens of millennia, human beings did not have pottery. Physiologically, there's nothing different from those people, and ourselves even, 40, 50, sometimes 60,000 years. There's no brain capacity different, there's no physiological structure different. But at some point, beginning about 6,000 BC, we find the appearance of pottery. And there is a revolution in pottery where you have thrown pots as opposed to coiled clay pots. The appearance of the thrown pots is an incredible expression of the coordination of hand and eye. If you've ever thrown a pot, you know you have to feel the clay in its total movement for the center, and you go for the center with your thumbs, the two thumbs together. So it's a balancing of the hands. But if you try to do it by the eye at first, you usually go off center, so that you have to have like a little stylus to trail in and make that little spiral in order to find the center. The eye isn't coordinated with the hands. But after a while, someone who's really good at throwing pots could throw a perfect pot blindfolded. Their hands and their inner eye are so coordinated, their sense of touch is so coordinated, that they find the center by this kind of kinesthetic inner balance. And if you talk to a master potter, if he's able to bring that moment of finding the center up for introspection and is capable of expressing himself somewhat, he will say that the pot flows from the fingers at that point. So that when you have a pot made in that way, you can feel later on the form flowing from the fingers of the potter. You can actually feel that. Now usually they'll refine it like on the inside of moving the thumbs up and down and taking some of the ridging out, but you can if you put your hands into the well-made pot, to give it a phrase, you can feel how the form has come out of the fingers. The Greek term poiesis means that. It means creation by the hands, and the whole thing in the Renaissance is symbolized like in the Sistine Chapel. God touches man with one finger. God is so incredibly capable that he only has to touch with one finger, and he makes not a pot out of the clay, but makes man out of the clay. Do you understand the whole metaphor? Can you appreciate the symbolic oomph that's in this? So that the whole consideration of balancing hand and eye on the mind, and of honing the mind so it's able to conduct this balance perfectly. And you know that any balance, in terms of its accuracy and perfection, is in terms of its refinement. And the perfect balance is only capable if the balance is on a single point. And I think maybe some of you have seen, there used to be, in times when metallurgy came in And I think we still have them around today. My friend Dr. Heller has one on his desk, of a piece of metal that's coiled on the table and then comes up to a single spike. And then there are two little figures balanced on another piece of metal, and there's only a little dot, only a little speck of indentation in the crossbar. And it has to sit exactly on the sharp point. And it seems like impossible that you could do this, but if you get it exactly right, it perfectly balances. There is only, and notice now the symbolic power in this, there is only one point where the balance is possible. So that the more that the mind is perfected, the less leeway you have for balancing. And the only balance finally possible is that of perfection. So that the balancing of the hand and the eye in the most refined state is capable of only being done with a perfect mind. So that the Hellenic spirit has this as its ideal. And that statue of Zeus throwing the lightning bolt or the javelin, you see that in the physical body, the musculature, the skeletal structure, the posture, the human form, it's all exaggerated to show that this is the coiled spring of the perfect form of man ready to create. Zeus, coordinating hand and eye, is the great god of the Hellenic spirit in the sense that he makes this manifest. Two qualities, the hand and the eye, are needed. Two qualities which in many ways are antithetical. Not antithetical like in a blind polarity, but antithetical in the sense that the way in which you usually learn to coordinate the hand is opposite of the way in which you learn to coordinate the eye. The hand is here, the eye is there. The hand doesn't lend itself to distance so well, but the eye does. So that the God form of the manifestation of the perfection of the eye was Apollo. In Apollo's Homeric epithet, in the Homeric poems, all of the characters and the gods and major things in nature have a little stock phrase called the epithet. Apollo is the far darter. And of course the bow. But not only the bow, but the accurate glance. Apollo is the far darter. He is the epitome of the eye. And the sun, as his chariot, is the epitome of the cosmic eye. So the Apollonian sense of form is a visual comprehension. It's a visual comprehension whose primary nature is composition. Edward Weston, the great American photographer, said composition is the strongest way of seeing. So that the Apollonian sense is to be able to compose with geometric penetrating accuracy at a distance with the eye. This is the power, and we have to use the Greek term here, dynamis. This is the power of art. The power of art. In whatever media one is working, the power of art is that man, once he learns to do this, can turn that technique upon himself. He can compose himself. He can compose himself not only as he is here and now, but in terms of the life flow of a whole life. He can look into the future of his own movement and development and compose not only the pattern of that movement, but compose a self which is able to live out that pattern. And the ancient Hellenic quality of the self is different from the one that we have today. It's radically different. When we ask children today to draw someone, very often you'll get this kind of a figure with the body as a target, and you get the limbs appended off. The classical Greek children did not draw that kind of a figure at all, but they drew what is recognizable today as the kind of mobile artist's mannequin that still you can find in art shops, still around. Homeric man was not here, but he was mobile. He was able to go anywhere. So that the Hellenic spirit is quite different from our natural comportment of today. And yet, the Hellenic Apollonian quality is very much with us still today. We still recognize it, but it's very difficult to bring into process. Why is this so? There's a major problem in civilization, a major problem in human development. It's applicable to everyone. It's a strategic, structural problem that we all have. No one's exempt. What is the difference? The difference is that we have, in our regard, use the French term here, in our regard for life, we have a balance which the Hellenic Greeks did not have without going through the laborious process of trying to make that balance happen. We have an implicit balance which the Hellenic spirit had to fight to struggle for. That's why we have, in the children's drawings of human beings, very often we have a target self here. In little children, usually it's expressed by just the face. All they have to do is draw the face. It was not true 2,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago. It is not true. You almost never even see the face. It was the mobility of the form that was important and not the existential there-ness of the face or the target-like body. Why is this so? In the most grand strategic way, we have an integration of the Apollonian eye with another quality that's there in the hand, which for the Hellenic spirit, they recognized that it needed to be balanced, but it was a struggle, and the struggle was all contingent on what you could do with your mind. Now, the other side of that Apollonian eye is the Dionysian hand. The Dionysian hand. It's a ritual quality, as a ritual myth quality, as opposed to a magic art quality. Apollo is a magic art quality. Dionysius is a ritual myth quality. All centered around what one does with one's hands, in like a hands-on kind of a quality. We still get the sense when a rabbi puts hands on, or a healer puts hands on, it's this fundamental quality, basis, that life is a transmissible power, and that the hands have that. It's just like in, we were talking earlier about making the pot, how the appearance of ceramics in human history is very recent, comparatively recent. After 30,000 years, 40,000 years, 50,000 years of Homo sapiens, sapiens with no ceramics, all of a sudden, there are ceramics. And one moves very quickly from the coiled pot construction to the throne pot. And that we talked about how the pot flows out of the fingers, that you can feel in a well-made pot, you can feel the finger form. I'll bring out a couple of ceramics made by my friend up in Calgary, Alberta, Durancho. He's just a master craftsman at this. And let you see, you can feel it. And how that creation that flows out of the fingers, that the epitome of that is that in the Renaissance of that whole ideal, the Sistine Chapel of God creating man out of one finger. Man can create a pot, God can create a man, just one finger. It's like Zeus with his lightning bolt. So that the poesis, the creation here, has everything to do with this complication of the hand and the eye and their balance on the mind. Now what you've been doing with your haiku, with your writing haiku, with your poetry, you've been working with the eye. Haiku is largely a visual or visual expression that's done through language. One sees, or one sees inside. So this assignment on making a sculpture, or working with a little sculptural form, throws us back to the other side of this balance immediately. So you're moving from the haiku that you have today to next week, bringing in your sculpture as far as you've gone. Some clay, some plaster of Paris, some kind of form that you can manipulate, some kind of media that you feel comfortable with, whatever it is. It isn't to make a world-class sculpture, it's to make available for your introspection a process which we must make conscious now. We must make this process conscious. For us, the problem, the struggle, is making it conscious. For the ancient Hellenic spirit, the problem was that it was too difficult. It was conscious, and it was a struggle to do it, to make it happen. For us, it's very easy to do it, but it's very difficult to make it conscious. Why? Because we have to throw ourselves back and reach that kind of inner balance in order to recognize the values in their fullness. We automatically integrate hand and eye in our personality. We automatically weave ritual myth into psychic energy personality without ever thinking about it. And this weaving very often is dependent not on our activity, but on the activity of the culture, on the activity of the civilization. If the civilization starts to skew, the people skew, and they don't even know it. And because we live in such god-awful, decadent times, where the cultural and the sociological and the civilized forms are distorted almost into nightmarish shape, we're coming up distorted people without even understanding that we're being bent in the wash of the waves of forces that we have delegated long ago, made subconscious long ago, and have no chance to rectify unless we can make it conscious, unless we can bring it into consciousness. So that's what we're after now. We're after in this art section to understand poesis, to understand the making, the creating, and that from this, there's a creating from the hand and there's a creating from the eye, and that they can be balanced, and that the bringing of a quality of stillness of mind into that process balances them out. The hand and the eye then flow. The Japanese, as usual, have perfected to greased lightning, this kind of a technique, and the technique is summarized in the Japanese way by sumi-e painting. We talked about this several times, where a sumi-e master will have a whole table full of jars of inks, of various washes, and maybe a big tower of brushes. And behind him will be a huge roll of rice paper with another roller with a clip, and that will be unrolled and drawn taut and fixed with stays, so that behind him will be a drum taut sheet of rice paper, and before him is a whole array of inks and various washes and jar of brushes. And his activity is to balance himself inwardly, so that when he moves for the brush and the ink and turns and does his composition and comes back and puts the brush back, that whole activity is one movement. The only way that can be one movement is that Zen-like stillness and suffering. If at any time there's a hitch, if at any point there's a partition, he will tear the paper. The brush will go right through it, and the composition will be ruined. So that's like putting it into a Japanese Zen-like ideal. What we are after is to understand how a personality is made in just this way, but in vast, slow motion compared to that. A personality is a composition which balances the hands and what we do, and the eye and how we conceive of what we do with what we are yet to do, and the balance of that with who we are, and that composition, while being very delicate, is also, when it's done right, indefinitely strong, because there are, to put it in a colloquial phrase, no moving parts. That personality is incredibly durable. How durable? Physiological death has no effect on it whatsoever. That kind of durability. So the problem here is not only one of art, but in the deeper sense, one of religion. It's a religious quality which is lurking here in the artistic problem. And any artist who really has dedicated himself to his art understands that this is a primordial universal process. This is not a decorative process. This is not an ornamental process. It's not a secondary process. It is, in fact, the only real primary process that there is. For in order to do the art right, one has to have done the myth ritual right, the symbolic mental right, and the psychic energy making capacity right. All of that has to be done. But the ritual of the activity and the compositional purpose of the expressive structure need to be balanced on the symbol. And this is very, very, very difficult to do. In classic times, in classical Greece, in the 4th century BC, a handful of Greek geniuses were able to do this. The mass population was not able to do this, and it broke the civilization. And it was like a people who had done such close needlework so long that they became myopic, unable to do close-in work anymore. And they could use the examples of those who had been successful at doing this to teach others, but they never themselves could do it again. if you go to see that film classic with Melina McCurry, Never on Sunday, why are the Greeks not great like they used to be? Why is that so? Because they are enjoying life. But there's a peculiar kind of unrecognized tragedy in them. They're able to enjoy life, but they are not able to use that dynamis, that power, to extend that enjoyment of life to great compositions. There are no more Sophocles in Greece. Kazantzakis was a Cretan, isn't he? He wasn't a classical Greek. He was educated in Paris and with Bergson and read his Nietzsche and so forth. He was not a Greek. He was a European. The key to the whole thing is Euripides' play, The Bacchae. Because The Bacchae is the document from the time. It's the front page headline that the Greek spirit has been broken. In the sense that in order to balance the Dionysian power with the Apollonian compositional capacity, one needed to have a perfect mind. A perfect mind. The two elements had become so attenuated that a 90% perfect mind no longer would do. One had to have 100%. And to borrow a phrase from William Faulkner, it broke the point of the pencil. He couldn't write anymore with that. And Euripides' Bacchae is the document of the old, aged, last great tragedian saying, we have broke the point of the pencil of the mind. We can go on, but the only way that we can go on is to slide back into a Dionysian quality of just enjoying life, not making too much out of it anymore. Not trying to balance through composing purposes and strategies our capacity just to live. And the Bacchae by Euripides has this eerie quality because it is written in exile from Athens, far in the hinterlands. He'd been exiled to barbarian territories. He was at that time a very old man, 70 at that time, is very, very old, equivalent to 90 or something today. And the Bacchae has this quality. Now, the protagonist who is trying to balance this is Pentheus. Pentheus means man of suffering. Man of suffering. He is trying to balance the arrival in the tragedy of Dionysus and his chorus of maenads, of mad women. Not mad and like loony, but mad in the sense that these women are just ritual primordial women. They don't have anything to do with the Apollonian structures of life. The family means nothing to them. The city means nothing to them. Monogamous relationship means nothing to them. Civilization means nothing to them. They wear fawn skins. They carry the thyrsus, the staff with the pine cone and the ivy wrapped around. And they have these kinds of wild tambourines. And they're mantic women. And their whole being is to bring other women out of the homes, out of the cities, out of civilization, out of the relationships which have Apollonian structural qualities to them, take them out of that and have them join them, bring them back to that mantic mode. When the Bacchae begins, Dionysus comes in
before the palace of Pentheus in Thebes. At one side of the stage is a monument of Semele. Above it burns a low flame, and around it are the remains of ruined and blackened masonry. Semele. Semele is the mother of Dionysus. It's the mother of Dionysus. And Dionysus' father, Cadmus. It reads like this. Dionysus says, I am Dionysus, son of Zeus. My mother was Semele, daughter of Cadmus. My mother was Semele, son of Cadmus. I was delivered from her womb by the fire of a lightning flash. So that Cadmus is the grandfather of Dionysus. Well, Cadmus is also the grandfather of Pentheus. So that Pentheus and Dionysus have the same grandfather. They're sibling in this sense. And Cadmus is the founder of Thebes, of Greek Thebes. And notice that Thebes in Greece is named after Thebes in Egypt. Thebes in Egypt is the original metropolis. I almost call it a Theopolis because it was just a religious city, a massive religious city. Originally, Thebes in Egypt, in ancient archaic Egypt, had so many ceremonial temples that it was like the image I can find you today. It was like a string of civic centers all put together for religious purposes rather than political purposes. It was a massive place. Now, Thebes in Greece was founded in Minoan Mycenaean times, somewhere around 1600 BC. So that the events that are happening here are around 1500 BC. So that the events that are being related here, though Euripides is writing of them around 400 BC, he's writing about events 1,000 years before. He's writing about events half a turn of a 2,000 year period before. And he's saying that somehow those events then have lined up with events now. And this is a recognizable form. It's like in the 20th century, depth psychology saying that 1,000 years ago, alchemical processes have something to do with the nature of the psyche now. That in this spread of 1,000 years, somehow we're on the opposite end of a great circle. And that there is a diagonal energy coming from that opposite side of the circle to us today. And we're renewing, we're reliving, we're re-experiencing what happened then, and everything that's unresolved then is coming to us unresolved and amplified now. The only way to balance that, the only way to deal with what's happening now, is to project our mind, Apollonian style, to go back and see what was the problem there, what was the irresolution there, and how does it link with the irresolution here, and to come to some kind of purposeful movement towards a massive resolution of both. So that it takes a raising, an exponential raising, of the mind's conscious compositional capacity. One has to be a person now on a higher level. You can't just be a person in terms of good civic behavior. That's not enough. Or even good Greek behavior, a good national behavior. That's not enough. One has to now be a person on the highest level in terms of a universal problem. Some universal problem. The tragedy of the Bacchae is that the Greek compositional quality was not up to it. The best that could be done was like Euripides and Plato of that generation, of seeing what the problem was, of identifying very accurately This is the problem. And Plato again and again in his dialogues says our problem is that we do not know how to live together on the level that we must now live together, because the quality of the person is not refined enough to yield these more necessary larger forms. We can't have a republic anymore because a city-state's not enough. A league of city-states is a mechanical pastiche. It's not the real form. We need a larger form to float this, and we are incapable of making it happen. And Plato's pupil Aristotle will identify it. He says the problem has come to such an amplification that we can no longer live simply as Greeks, that the problem is a problem of mankind. We have to live as human beings. We have to live as a single mankind, and we can't even live as pan-Hellenic Greeks, much less on this other level. Because the quality of the person is not refined enough to float this more comprehensive universal structure. Does this sound familiar? Does it sound like what the late 20th century is up against? It should. The basic problem is problem in person making. The person is like the sacrificial fuel for that sacred refining fire. You can't have a world-class civilization unless you have world-class personalities who are able to live in that way, contribute in that way, feel comfortable with their lives in that way. There's no way that you can have a form without the support of the persons who can make that form live. The problem came up in Euripides' time, and he saw that the Greeks had evolved tremendously, but that they had created in their evolvement a conscious problem, a problem with consciousness which could no longer be strong enough to balance the tremendous dynamic that was coming out of them in terms of life. Because the stronger you compose consciously, the more you evoke the power of life to come out. And when you get to a certain level, the evocation evokes more than you can deal with. Notice that this is the very theme which in the alchemical language is personified by Faust, whose purposeful desires of consciousness, of comprehension, evokes more than he can handle. Evokes what? Evokes the powers of the underworld. Dionysus is the powers of the underworld compared to the Apollonian consciousness of form, and the only way to balance them is on a perfection of mind built on a refinement of the symbol to a single pointedness. And Euripides, in the tragedy, displays for us with just consummate artistic skill the fact that in his time, in his lifetime, right at the end, the Greeks lost it. And they never recovered it. They never recovered it. So we have a very peculiar quality here. And I'm going to come back to this a little bit after the break, but I want to just let this rest with you. And I guess you can understand that you should get a copy of the Bacchae by Euripides. And I think you can understand that maybe you should read it minimally. And read it with some attentiveness. What is going on here? Now notice that the attentiveness is one of differentiation. So when you come across a word or a character or something that you don't know, go to a dictionary, go to an encyclopedia, try and inform yourself. Robert Graves' little book on the Greek myths, which is out in Penguin Books, is a good little thing to have around. Graves spent a long time on this because he had very little to do on long, hot evenings in Mallorca sometimes, and in between his chatting with the people and so forth, listening to the surf, he put this together. It's an amazingly fine book. For starters, look up Semele. And try and find out. Now, remember when we did the mythic images? Remember when we worked with those mythic images? Semele is...